I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Today on the Spark My Muse podcast, my guest is philosopher Diana Shea, author of Responsibility and Luck, A Defense of Praise and Blame. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm really glad to be here.
And so one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the show is to talk a little bit philosophically, but sort of in a place where we can practically come at some of these problems and things that are in our lives every day that we might not think about as impacting us, but that actually do play into our lives. And maybe you could explain for us, what is this classic problem of moral luck that you get into in your book?
Yeah, so it's a funny kind of problem. It's one that came up in about the 70s in contemporary philosophy. And there was a lot of sort of discussions going on, and it sort of merged out of those. And the major person who formulated it is a philosopher known as Thomas Nagel. And what he's looking at is this problem of how much control do we really have over our lives versus how much is a matter of luck. And generally we think, as he put it, it's a kind of intuitive idea, that moral responsibility requires control. If we're going to be morally responsible for something, we had to control it. But then he says, look, when we look really closely, we find that luck is everywhere, and maybe we really don't control nearly as much as we thought. And so, wow, like maybe we can't be responsible for anything at all. Would you like me to give some examples of this?
Yeah, because when you say luck, it's hard to know exactly what you mean as far as what does that word even mean?
Yeah, so for Thomas Nagel, it just means something over which I don't have control. And I would also say it's something over which we don't have knowledge, because I mean, it's not a matter of luck that the sun rose this morning.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I don't have control over that, but I knew it was coming, right? So
right.
We can't say that was luck. So generally, it's things that are, you know, outside of our knowledge, outside of our control. So the example that I actually open my book with is the case of a drunk driver. So there are lots of drunk drivers out there every night, unfortunately. And most of them, or at least some portion of them, drive home drunk and get home safely and sleep it off on their sofa. And they never get caught and they never suffer any horrible consequences. But then there's the drunk drivers who kill somebody, and they didn't exercise any more caution, any more care, any more responsibility than the drunk driver who managed to get home to his sofa safely without doing that. Mm-hmm. And so it's a matter of luck in a way, whether the drunk driver doing this negligent thing actually kills somebody or not. Mm-hmm. And so Nagel would say, well, look, maybe we can't hold him responsible for that, because he didn't really control whether he killed somebody. He acted the same way as this other guy. Hmm. And it was just his bad luck that he ended up killing somebody. So that's actually a kind of moral luck that concerns with the outcomes of your actions. There's also moral luck that's concerned with the moral judgment of the action itself. So this is called circumstantial moral luck. Hmm. So again, to give a bit of an extreme example, let's say you take two men, both of whom are planning to murder their wives. Sorry, I don't mean to be picking on men in this. It just happened to be the examples that I picked out are examples of men. You could do this with women. Well, let's say two women who are planning to murder their husbands, and one of them actually goes through with it. You know, she puts this plan into place. She ends up, poisoning her husband, let's say. The other woman, her husband happens to die in an auto accident the night before she planned to poison him. So instead of being the murderer, she is the grieving widow. So mm-hmm. she's gotten everything that she wanted, but she didn't have to do anything wrong. She doesn't have that murder on her her sort of moral books, right?
Okay.
She has all the planning, all of that stuff, but she didn't actually commit murder. And in general, both the law and morally speaking, we regard these things as differently. If you just look at least Colorado law, you know, it's a significantly less penalty if you just attempted murder versus if you actually committed it.
Right.
And then there's something called constitutive moral luck, which is about the kind of person you are, the kind of character you have. And the easiest kinds of examples here are, you think of two people who are raised in vastly different circumstances. We don't control the family into which we're born or the culture into which we're born. And it really matters in terms of whether you, what kind of moral decisions you would make later on in life, whether you were born in America in the 1970s as I was, or, you know, the 80s or 90s versus born into Germany in, you know, like 1910, 1920.
Right.
These kinds of things matters as to what moral choices you're going to make, what kind of person you're going to be, but you didn't control that. So how responsible are you? So that's the problem of moral luck. That's the conundrum that Thomas Nagel set out. And he basically says, there's no possible solution to this problem. You know, it's all just hopeless. It's just a kind of contradiction.
And so you develop those ideas and you go beyond some of what he's talking about. And there's limited control that we have, but then how do you develop that further?
Yeah. So what I did was I looked at this idea that he has, because he says it oftentimes in this classic seminal article of his, of it's just an intuitive idea that moral responsibility requires luck. And I'm like, is that really just intuitive? You know, like maybe there's something else there. And so I'm a big fan of Aristotle's work, particularly his Ethics. And so I went and looked at his theory of moral responsibility, which, you know, I mean, this is 2000 years old, you know, this is like old stuff, but come on, he's got some interesting things to say here. Can't we find something that might be helpful? And what I found was that it was right on point. You know, here this, you know, 2000 years earlier, this philosopher, it's not, you know, it's not as if he was dealing with this problem of moral luck or was aware of it, but just so much was there that could be developed that was a clear answer to Nagel. And so Aristotle's idea of control is not this vague wishy-washy, oh, we've got some intuitive notion. He's like, no, let's look at what control actually entails. Control actually entails a power to do or not to do something. That's what we mean by control. It means that you faced alternatives and you had the power to do or not do something. So there's a difference here. There's a difference here between when you, let's say a criminal attacks you. And there's a difference between when he grabs you and puts you in the trunk of his car versus when he points a gun at you and says, get in the trunk of the car. So in one case, assuming that you physically tried to resist and you couldn't, you didn't have the power to not be put in the trunk of the car. In the case where somebody's pointing a gun at you, you do have a choice. Now, unfortunately, your choice there might be to get shot or to get in the trunk of the car, right? But there's still like you're a rational person. You get to make a decision about which course you're taking. And again, getting in the trunk of the car might be the better thing. It might not be the better thing, but there's still a power of choice. And similarly, there's a difference between if you, let's say, run down a hill, I don't know why I have this image in my head on these kind of cases, but you run down a hill and run into a table that's set with a wedding, you know, wedding display and a wedding cake. And you run down the hill and boom, you slam into the wedding cake and knock it over. Versus a case where you're just standing there minding your own business and the wind knocks you into it. You know, there's a difference in control. In one case, you had control. You could have stopped and you chose not to. And in the other case, you were the victim of these external forces. So this is the kind of thing that Aristotle is concerned with as a condition for moral responsibility, is that we have control in this, in a very specific kind of way. We're going to ask, did you have the power to do this or not do this? And that's going to be critical for moral responsibility. He's also going to say, did you know what you were doing at the time? Because sometimes we're mistaken in ways. We literally didn't know what we were doing. And so for example, we've all had this experience where you walk out into the parking lot and you try to get into a vehicle that turns out not to be your own, which you realize in short order is like, it's not, oh wow, this isn't my car, right? There's a difference between that and actually trying to break into somebody's car. Like, you were just mistaken about what you were doing. You thought you were trying to get into your car. You were actually trying to get into somebody else's, but that doesn't make it an attempted theft.
Right.
So that's the kind of thing that he's talking about. So you need to have both control over what you're doing and you need to know what you're doing. And that's what makes moral responsibility possible.
Yeah, well, let me ask a question about that. I was just totally by happenstance, because we set this interview up a while ago, but just yesterday I was listening to a podcast, because I'm kind of a podcast addict, and I was listening to a podcast where the neuroscientist named James Fallon was looking at PET scans of brains, and he happened to be looking at brain scans of psychopaths, and he was also looking at Alzheimer's scans of his family members, and they had been intermixed, and he realized that one of his family's brain scans had gotten mixed in, and he realized his family members was also had all the markings of a psychopath, and he decided he would have to inform one of his family members. They had all the brain marks of a psychopath, and then he realized that it was his brain scan.
Oh dear!
Did you hear this? So but this was in the Smithsonian magazine. And so he's not a psychopath that has acted out on that, but he has all the markings of it, and he realized that he might have been like a psychopath. And I think like Bonnie or Lizzie Borden is in his family tree. And so there are killers. I think there are 7 convicted killers in his family tree that are psychopathic killers. And he had a very nurturing upbringing, apparently. And so he says he's very, very, very competitive, but he'd rather win at an argument than, you know, beat you up kind of thing. But he has all the markers. And so you wonder, in a naturalistic sense, does he really have a choice? It's the nurture has taken over for him in this case, in his life. But, you know, in slightly different circumstances, he might be in jail for having killed somebody too.
Yeah.
And so what chance does he have really in terms of control over his condition? And
so
how does that jive with that theory?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's a really interesting kind of case, because he's clearly somebody who's not acted out. But we all know families that where the kids are raised in basically the same kind of environment, same kind of atmosphere, and there's 3 good kids and 1 really bad one. We all, like, there's a lot of choice involved, and I think we can all reflect on this as kids, or we reflect on this when we were children, about choices that we made and how much we did actually have the power to choose one way or the other. And I made my share of bad choices as a kid, but I also made my share of good choices that enabled me to overcome the bad ones ultimately. But I don't think I don't think it's just a nature versus nurture. I think that's a false alternative. I think there's a lot of choice that goes on, a lot of deliberation, a lot of seeing the consequences of what we do and deciding whether that's something that we want or not, even when we are children. And so it's interesting that he has this potential. And my view is, I would admire him all the more for being the decent person, for consistently day after day making the better choice, which is something that a lot of people don't do, even if they have the really great upbringing. And honestly, even if they have the great upbringing and don't have the tendency to be the psychopath, right? There's a lot of people who made bad choices day in and day out. And so, I mean, I think it's really interesting, these kinds of, you know, like, what are we born with? What are we kind of saddled with? Mm-hmm. And how much, I mean, I think there's genuine questions about how much we blame people who particularly who've been raised in really particularly awful circumstances. I think those are tough, tough questions. Mm-hmm. But I think we can also look at, you know, like, did you know what you were doing, and did you have the power to make a better choice here? And you know, sorry, like, if you made the wrong choice again and again and again, that's because that's what you wanted to do, that's what you thought was the right course. And yeah, there's going to be consequences to that in terms of people not wanting to deal with you, or you know, family members not wanting contact with you, or worse, you know, being sent to prison and so on. And these are things that you would know in advance. These are not surprises. These are not You know, if you steal your mom's car and sell it for drug money, it's not going to be a surprise that she's going to be angry with you and might not trust you in the future.
So would you say that whether you have a fantastic nurturing upbringing and you make a bunch of wrong choices because you have a psychopathic genetic predisposition, or you're raised in a horrendous upbringing, but you have all the brain markers to be a quiet, introverted librarian, you know, that ultimately you get to pick, you get to pick from a string of decisions, and you get to make those decisions, and ultimately it's up to you. I mean, is that kind of the contention that?
I wouldn't put it quite that way. I do think there's genuine questions here about how responsible people are that really depend on the particulars of their circumstances. But I think my default assumption, and I think this is Aristotle's default assumption too, is that there's enough choices around that people are responsible. You know, you reach a certain age, and we tend to, I think this is the kind of common sense kind of view in a way, that like, okay, if you're a kid and you're making bad choices, we might not think that's all about, you know, we're not gonna condemn you completely yet. But, you know, by the time you hit 30, you're still, particularly, you know, you're hurting people, you're behaving badly, you're engaged in criminal activity. Like, yeah, you know the score. And this is the life that you're choosing to lead.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I mean, I tend to think that by the time people reach a certain age, they've done enough crafting of themselves that they are responsible for who they are, whatever burdens they were, whatever sort of advantages or burdens they had to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all have some. I mean, we all mm-hmm. have some advantages. We all have some burdens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. And it's true that your prefrontal cortex isn't really developed completely till you're 25. And then after that, there's a lot of neuroplasticity research coming out that you can still make changes. And I think that that's what this particular neuroscientist is like. I'm kind of determined now to be, to overcome the what I know my brain is like. I'm kind of determined now to be a different sort of person than people are expecting, now that I've come out publicly about that I'm a psychopath. So
you know, and that's kind of self-knowledge. Like, that's really helpful for people to know, oh look, I have this tendency. I've just been thinking about this with my own personal issues lately, and realizing, well, I have a much stronger tendency to people please than I realized. And so this is something I have to actively work against if I don't just want to fall into this as a default. And so, I mean, that's not in principle different than his. I mean, his is a tougher problem in a way, but all of us have those kinds of tendencies. Whatever our personality is, we have the failure modes that are really easy for us, the kinds of easy wrong things that we can do. Nobody I think has smooth sailing in life.
That's very good. And so in terms of when we're doing things like coaching or teaching, parenting, or vocational things and professional things, as we're keeping these things in mind, or character building, whether in ourselves or helping other people in character building situations, you know, what are some of the things that we can keep in mind in terms of choice and in terms of helping people to know that they even have a choice, or to keeping those things in mind?
Yeah. So I think it's important to know what you can control and know what you can't. I think that's really, really helpful in life, to figure out what is it that I have, and to understand control in this very Aristotelian way. What is it that I have the power to do or not do here? What are the alternatives that I'm facing? And just to be very, very clear about that, because oftentimes we think, well, I just have to keep doing X. I can't possibly quit my job. No, like, this is America. You can quit your job, right? You can quit your job and you don't need to go to the gulag. This is something that you have the power to do. You might not like the alternative, but this is still something that you have the power to do or not do. You have the power to say no when people ask you to participate in projects. You have the power to say yes to that. Right. These are things that you can do. The other thing is that I think it's really important. One of the things that comes out in my book is this importance of judging the choices that people make, either our own choices or other people's choices, in the context of, or judging what people did or who they are or what the results of their actions are, in the context of what alternatives they actually faced. And Aristotle has this great example that I think of quite often of a ship captain who throws goods overboard in a storm. Because normally, if you're a ship captain, you do not wish to be throwing goods overboard in a storm. This would be a, like, if you're on, you know, calm seas, this would be a really dumb, horrible, stupid thing to do. But if you are in a storm and it's basically between saving the ship and saving the goods, of course you throw the goods overboard in the storm. And oftentimes our choices are like that. We face hard choices. We face, you know, we face worse and even worse options, or bad and worse options. And, or sometimes we face good, you know, good options and even better ones. And sometimes it can be hard to accept this is the best I can do right now. But that's something I think that's also worth keeping in mind. And not just judging people in the way that sort of Santa is supposed to judge people, like you were naughty or nice in this circumstances. Like, hey Santa, you know, I might have been a little bit naughty here, but this was the best I could do in these circumstances. Or hey, maybe I was nice, but really I could have done much, much better. So there's those kinds of things, which I think are really useful for thinking about, both for ourselves, being kind to ourselves, being kind to others, being kind but fair to ourselves and to others.
Maybe you can explain your subtitle, In Defense of Praise and Blame, because I'm not sure that I grasp the subtitle from what we've been talking about so far.
Sure. So what I'm doing is I'm defending moral responsibility, and I'm saying, look, Thomas Nagel is wrong. Luck, yes, there's luck in life. Yes, it's pervasive, but that doesn't prevent us from exercising a good measure of control. It doesn't prevent us from knowing what we're doing. And if we are morally responsible, then we can be praised and blamed for things. Now, I don't give a separate justification for here's why it's worthwhile to praise and blame people. Well, no, that's not true. I do actually do that, but it's not a big portion of the book. It shows up in chapter 4. Here's why it's important to be praising and blaming people. It's one needs to be doing this in order to know, like, who are the people that I wish to ally with or not? Or am I, you know, should I be doing better in life? And praise and blame is one of the ways that we do that. We figure out what our own standards are. We make sure that we're living up to them. We make sure that the people around us are living up to, you know, that they're morally decent too. So that's part of, by defending moral responsibility, I'm defending the permissibility of this practice of praising and blaming people.
And holding people responsible, or holding ourselves responsible in certain circumstances.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Well, that's really good. And are there other things that we need to keep in mind when it comes to taking actions in our world around us?
I think it's just the things that I would emphasize is this importance of knowing what you can control or not, and being very, very clear, very, very clear about that. I find, and oftentimes, even if you can't control it, you can't control it fully. Maybe you can make some progress. So, even take something. I'm one of these people. I'm a terrible sprinter, right? There's some people who are really great sprinters just by nature, and I'm a terrible sprinter. But I can be better. I can be a little bit faster. I can have better reaction times. And so that's something that I can work on. I don't have full control over that. But I can be better. And that's something that also morally speaking as well matters. You know, maybe I've been the kind of person who's been telling lots of white lies here and there. And, you know, the question is, can I do better on this? Maybe it would actually be impossible for me to change all my habits overnight. But I'm faced with this moment right now. Can I do better and tell and say the honest thing? Yeah, I think I can do that. That's something that's in my power to control.
Well, that kind of brings up a point about morality in general, and whose morality are we speaking about? Because people have different ideas about what morality is, right? I mean, because somebody from maybe a gang would think about respect and honor and morality in one in defending their turf, and
right.
is that, you know, things would be morally excusable, that other people would really shudder at the thought. And so whose morality is the right one?
So I think we can look at that. Actually, that gang morality is a good example. It's a kind of honor-based morality and, mm-hmm. and hierarchical. And we can look at, well, what are the actual practical effects on the lives of the people who practice this? Mm-hmm. And it generally means that they're going to be in prison or killed at a young age. That to me is a non-successful morality. Like, this is not, I think that one should want to live a long, happy life. And if you're going to do that, then living in that kind of moral climate, putting yourself into that kind of moral climate is clearly not the way to do it. And I think that the way we figure out the facts about how we should live morally is by looking at what are the kind of characteristic ways in which I need to act if I want to live a long, happy, successful, interesting, meaningful kind of life. And I think that requires a bunch of things for each individual to do on their own in terms of being very rational and having good principles and being honest with themselves, which is, you know, not deceiving themselves just because they not believing things just because they want to. Mm-hmm. And it also entails treating other people well. I mean, we can look around and see the people who treat others badly, mm-hmm. the people who are scheming and conniving and manipulating and trolling. These are people who are not ultimately happy. They do not have fulfilling, satisfying relationships. They do not have business partners who are eager to do business with them. And so they're losing out on an enormous amount of opportunity, enormous amount of value that life has to offer. And so this is why it's important to treat other people with respect and respect the fact that, you know, they're actual persons with their own goals and that they're not just tools to be used and manipulated. And obviously this is a huge conversation about what the proper moral principles are, but that's my basic approach this is basically Aristotle's approach, as well, is to, like, let's look around and see what, and I mean, we all want to flourish, right? Let's look and see what kinds of principles enable us to do that. Mm-hmm. And then let's go live by those principles.
Yeah, he's a very common sense, practical guy in terms of morality and common sense principles.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Yeah, I appreciate that about him kind of getting down to business about that. And well, this has been really great. Where can people find more about your work and listen to some of your podcast episodes that you've done?
Yeah, so they could find me at philosophyinaction.com. I've actually recently retired from podcasting, but there's a ginormous archive of my past work that people can check out. And for anybody interested in my book in particular, they can go to philosophyinaction.com/moral luck and they will find Amazon links and free chapters and a couple podcasts on the book itself and so on.
That's good. I will also have show notes that will link back to those as well. If anybody goes to sparkmymuse.com and looks up this episode, the show notes will be there with all those direct links. So I really appreciate your time, Diana, and this was really great. Thank you so much.
I appreciate your having me on the show. Thank you so much.
Show notes for this episode can be found at sparkmymuse.com. There you'll find details for websites and people and books mentioned in this episode, and sometimes you'll find photos and videos too. Please stop by and check it out.